Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Trent Bernard. Righto.
How you going?
Good. Good. Well, we put Churchill to bed. That sounds terrible. Hitler before that. This week on the Warrior U podcast, we're dissecting Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Between the three of these guys, you'd pretty much come up with the playbook for leadership. The do's and don'ts, I think. Might just stop the season. Rightio. Born in 1881 to a Turkish family in Salonika, the Ottoman Empire, which is now Thessaloniki. Anyway, it's somewhere in Greece. I've not been there. Although I have been to Sorrento. Is that Greece? No, that's Italy. Oh, God. Correct. Been somewhere in Greece. I've been to some island, which was thoroughly enjoyable. And his father was a military officer, so much like your son's father. God, I don't know. This is going to be an obtuse. This will be in a really obtuse podcast today. He attended a secular school and later on joined the Salonika Military School in 1893. And in 1899, he joined the Ottoman Military Academy, graduating in 1905. This all lines up nicely.
And that academy still exists. It's one of the longest running military academies in the world. Yeah, he was always keen to be a military officer. In fact, he refused to go to religious school. His mum wanted him to go to a religious school, but he avoided that. And during his time as an officer cadet at the war college, he was exposed to European and Asian influences. And that's where he started to get some of his belief systems and some of that background that he later used. He studied Napoleon, guerrilla warfare, strategy, tactics, those sorts of things. Mm. And that led him to believe that maybe Muslim modernity might be better attained through a more constructive type of Napoleonic figure. So right from the start, he had this set in his mind.
That's interesting. So he'd actually studied history and taken good pieces out of it, much like what we're trying to do here, I guess. You know, he was in prison for a while. He was an anti-monarchist, and then he was pardoned, as you do. He joined a revolutionary group of military officials who sought to reform the Ottoman Empire, and reform it he did. And he was posted to Bulgaria, Syria, and Libya to further prove his leadership abilities.
Yeah, he used to also write in an underground newspaper as well, which was quite divisive, and it sort of led to him being on the outer. And I think that's what led him to going to prison, to be honest.
What would be the communique of the day to soldiers? Like, don't, and what we don't want you to do is have your own Instagram account or write on underground newspapers. Mustafa, looking at you, Mustafa.
Yeah, while he was in Syria, though, that's where he started to get some of those military skills and accepting responsibility, exercising authority. So he really did his apprenticeship out there and he was able to really get his grounding. But he became more anti-Ottoman while he was out there. And later on, when he fought in Libya, he won acclaim through his personal magnetism, his speaking skills. He was really developing his leadership skills, and that's where he learned how to apply firsthand his previously studied theories, guerrilla warfare, psychological operations, those sorts of things. But he was, really disgruntled with the Turkish military at the time, the whole piece around corruption and unprofessionalism and things like that. He really wanted to drive modernization through the army at the time.
Do you think that he was not pro the Sultan, and he was more around multi-party politics? Like, he wasn't looking for democracy per se, but he was certainly a forward thinker, wasn't he?
From what I know of him, he actually did consider himself as a fellow of Western democratization.
Is that right?
And whilst he did, have a dictatorial streak to the way he imposed his modernization program, he was aiming for a modern democracy. In fact, he saw himself as a friend, a close brother or close cousin of the US, because later on down the track, as he took them through the War of Independence, he saw that similarity between the path he was taking Turkey through as Washington did. So he saw himself as an equal to Washington.
Wow. Now, it's interesting because Turkey was going through, well, not just Turkey, Europe was going through a really chaotic, tumultuous time in the early 1900s. You know, you had the Franco-Spanish war previous. No, you had the Italian-Turkish War, 1911, and then the Balkan Wars in 1912 to 13. And the Ottomans were, you know, they were up against it. They were up against it on multiple fronts over multiple years. And he saw service in all of those.
Yeah, on the Bulgarian front in the Balkan Wars preceding World War I. And that's where he further developed his staff work, his staff training, integrating intelligence, logistics, you know, the science of logistics, communications and staff functions, those sorts of things. And it further cemented his concern about the Turkish military. And he was deeply concerned at that point. He too saw the writing on the wall for a future world war, as did many other senior leaders around the world at that time.
Yeah.
And he knew they weren't ready.
So it's fair to say he saw a lot of service prior to World War One.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right. So to start off with, inspiration, motivation. I should caveat this today with saying that, you know, I'm a pretty high scorer. 10 out of
marker.
Yeah, 10 out of 10. So in his military career, he used, you know, he obviously had a big personality. He believed in nationalism. He would make decisive decisions, inspire those around him to follow his objectives, would show clarity in his goals and would drag people along. He used his knowledge of the human terrain, appealing, and was persuasive. He had a persuasive personality to convince the Turks, for instance, to fortify Gallipoli and repel the Allied invasion. And as we said last week, you know, when a nation is fighting on its home soil, it's pretty easy to motivate them.
Yeah, yeah. You talk about human terrain, but he was actually an extremely good tactician.
Mm.
And this was evident very early on during that Gallipoli campaign. It was actually Ataturk who, as the commander of the divisional reserve, where he identified Çulak Bair as decisive terrain. It was the decisive terrain for the defence of the Gallipoli Peninsula.
Mm.
And he moved early and without orders from his superior commander and committed his reserves to holding that ground. And that's an interesting story in itself.
And he was up, as we talked about last week with Monash, he was up against some fairly intellectual tacticians in their own right. And they had German military advisors, which we have to continue to probably remind people. But yeah. Gallipoli was, for him, Gallipoli falling, the Allies making inroads. What we're now talking about is the end of the Ottoman Empire, the end of a long reign of how many hundreds, if not nearly 1,000 years?
Well, it shows what a nationalist he was as well, because he had no love for the Ottoman Empire.
Mm.
It wasn't the Ottoman Empire he was fighting. He's fighting for. He was fighting for his nation.
Mm.
And its people, and particularly, and later on, after the war for independence, he actually gave credit to the peasants for the victory, and it just goes to show the type of person he was back there. He fought like the entire country depended on it, and of course it did.
I wonder if it's too long a bow to draw to compare the Turks of, you know, that sort of time in history to Australian soldiers. I wonder if. Because I know that people saw some similarities with the nation.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, I'm no expert on the society at the time, but certainly they were, from what I understand of the community, they were largely peasant based, agricultural. Which, you know, there are some similarities to the Australian Australian nation, but by comparison, I think Australia was far more modern compared with Turkey at the time.
Yeah, and I suppose culturally very, very different when you consider.
Indeed.
So, you know, he was passionate, had charisma, nationalism, appealed to the masses. He was had high moral courage. He could raise the morale of his troops. He saw troops and emphasised with Kemal, seeing them accept different missions as part of the greater good of defending Gallipoli. And so that strengthened the resolve and cohesiveness of the mission in the minds of the soldiers and their effectiveness. So he really was a servant leader.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, that highly motivational leader on the battlefield, he genuinely grabbed fleeing Turkish soldiers who were, you know, fleeing the advancing Allied forces on the Gallipoli Peninsula, and it forced them to lie down, you know, on the high ground, and commanded them to defend that position. And when they told him they had no ammunition, he said, "Fix bayonets. I do not expect you to attack. I expect you to die." And literally in that time that it takes you to die, more people will come and take your place, and we'll hold this ground. Essentially, that's what he said to his people, and he was given, you know, the German Iron Cross for that particular action, to hold that position. Mm.
Incredible. And you know, it's not a long bow to draw either to say that he was seen as a hero when the Allies left the Gallipoli Peninsula. He had single-handedly saved the Ottoman Empire, as the way that it was seen in folklore, and the rumour and innuendo must have started to get around. And this then saw him appointed to commanding the Caucasus and Palestine fronts during the end of the war, where he applied the same tactics he had applied at Gallipoli to inspire the soldiers. So we talk about leadership being an energy transference. It's not necessarily done standing on the soapbox. It's done in all those one-to-one conversations. That's where the energy magic is happening from a leadership perspective, and he showed that he could do this. You know, and I understand how uncomfortable it must be for Australians to hear, you know, about our loss at Gallipoli, and then to hear on the other side of it us glorifying a leader like himself. But you have to give credit where credit's due for what he was able to achieve in the face of, you know, what was pretty significant firepower from the ocean. And then if it wasn't for the terrain, I think, you know, they would have been done for, but he certainly helped them hold their line and their resolve.
Yeah, I agree. And also to say that we glorify Ataturk, I think history has been pretty fair to him, and he takes a lot of credit for everything that he did, and rightly so, for you know, the defense of Turkey and modernization of Turkey. He also gave credit to the Australian soldiers, and you know, in that famous epitaph that he's as part of his speech, telling, you know, the mothers of Australian soldiers not to cry, because they're now, you know, the bodies of their sons are now resting in Turkey. So you know, I think he was
goes a long way for healing, doesn't it? Really,
it does, and it shows the type of person he was.
Mm. What did he get up to after World War One? Do you know?
Well, he then led the Turkish war for independence against the occupying forces of Turkey, and then transformed the country.
And he was the leader of the Turkish nationalists, right? Which saw him inspire people and project. He was projected as the true leader of the Turkish people, which was solidified upon their victory in the war. His sole leadership saw him recognised as embodying the values and responsibilities of being the true leader, and inspired Turks to fight for their independence. What do you think of that?
Well, it's possibly a one-sided view of Ataturk's leadership style, because, you know, as I've said before, he also cajoled, he forced and bullied support through his time as a leader, but particularly during the War of Independence and through forcing through his reforms later as the leader of the country. He wasn't just an inspiring leader. He was a forceful, at times overly assertive, cajoling, threatening leader as well.
He was definitely able to create a nationalist narrative and agenda and a vision for people to follow.
Yeah, indeed.
What do you think, you know, the success of his motivation really seen in the relatively little opposition to his reforms and massive public approval? He was pretty much able to change anything and get it into, you know, get it into the government or get it changed.
Yeah, he had quite a close cohort of friends that were around him. His advisors were, many of them were actually officer cadets with him, and they'd come up through the ranks with him, but he was always the leader of them. He had more energy than anyone else.
He's the hardest worker in any room, right?
Yeah. That's why he dominated 100%. But there's a really good story about Ataturk, where he was sitting in a cafe, and he was a young officer or an officer cadet, I can't remember exactly. He's sitting in a cafe, he's sitting there with his mates, and one of them asks, "Hey, what do you want to be in 25, 30 years time?" And, you know, it's that old story. You know, what's your plans for your future? And one of them said, I want to be, they're all army officers at this stage. I want to be the foreign minister. And another one says, I want to be a general in the army. And, you know, they go on to talk about these very senior positions in government and the military and those sorts of things. And Ataturk at the time looks at them all. He's the last to speak. Let us talk last. Mm. The last to speak. And he says, I'm going to be the one that appoints you to all of those positions.
That sounds pretty cool. That's a good story. I like it. Do you reckon that's true?
Well, it comes from a family member of one of the people that was at the conversation.
Yeah, right. And, you know, it's safe to say that he also, and we'll get onto some other stuff in a minute, but he grew into the role. So not only you know, once he was in, as a statesman, he started to grow older and become more father-like and then become the father of modern Turkey. So some of the pros, he demonstrated consistent inspiration throughout his military and political life. What else? Able to develop and grow leadership from being a battlefield commander through to the president. Able to inspire people in both a military and political sense. And he had flexibility in his leadership approach. He was able to make strong, decisive decisions and take action, full responsibility, accountability for what he was doing as a leader. His reforms turned an archaic, conservative political and social system really into a modern, progressive democracy, demonstrated by the level of his inspiration into that and then by the amount of people that followed him and didn't really buck the system, to be fair. They just went along with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, for sure.
His continued adoration also demonstrated the lasting influence that his motivation had. And he used, this is the thing too, this is interesting, I thought, he used nationalist rhetoric, his own personal courage, stories and narratives, his hero status. You know, that demonstrates a flexibility and pragmatism in the way that he approaches the leadership style. And he kept a...
technology as well. Technology. Right. So he was an avid user of the telegraph.
Yeah.
Propaganda, psyops.
Now, interestingly, conservative Islamists within Turkey didn't love him.
Mm.
And that was probably the only con out of all this. So the pros outweigh the cons. But he was able to control them and it never became an insurgency during his era.
Yeah, he was in this aspect, I think he was quite astute. And the reason why is because one of his closest advisors and friends was in effect the senior member of the military. He was also a devout Muslim.
Mm.
And any time that he was getting severe pushback from the religious leaders towards his reforms, he would dispatch this particular gentleman to go and have a conversation over a cup of coffee with the religious leaders and smooth the waters. So he knew when to deploy his key assets to get his key messages across.
Mm.
And because of that trust and relationship, he was able to bridge that divide because he was no fan of religion being involved in government at all. And that was one of his major reforms, of course.
Yeah, that is interesting. He was able to control that narrative, which we talk about a lot as leaders should.
Indeed.
Communicate everything, communicate often. Yep. Okay, providing purpose and direction. I gave him 9 out of 10, Trent. So his initial capacity as a World War One commander, you know, you have to bear in mind his goal was to ensure Turkish victory and repulse Allied. It wasn't going to be on his watch. Mm. He wasn't going to fail. So he led the Ottoman Fifth Army in defending Gallipoli. He sought to compensate the British for naval dominance by defending the heights of the peninsula, which shows, you know, being tactically astute. He correctly anticipated that Allies would attack where they did attack, and slowed the invasion and drew it out into a campaign of attrition, really. Used his knowledge of the terrain to ensure the Ottomans held strong defensible positions and also made sure that there were counterattacks to everything that the Allies did.
Yeah, he did that more than a couple of times as well. And even when his troops were completely exhausted, he would force them to counterattack regardless of their levels of exhaustion and what had been going on during the previous attack by the Anzacs.
He really was down there in amongst it, leading, providing purpose and direction. And then after that success, he then went on to fight the Russians in the Caucasus, controlling the whole Turkish armies. And Enver Pasha was the commander previous, and his focus was victory at all costs and targeting Armenian civilians rather than Russian soldiers had led to the Ottoman armies being defeated on a couple of occasions. But Ataturk used the similar tactics that he used at Gallipoli, really drew it into a stalemate, and then used the terrain to his advantage.
He was quite an astute tactician, and you know, readily able to identify, you know, the center of gravity of the enemy and decisive in key terrain and those sorts of things that are just vital for defensive battles.
Yeah. So the previous commander of Enver Pasha, don't even know what I'm saying there. I'm going to edit that out. As a result of the Sultan allowing the partitioning of the Ottoman Empire and occupation of its territories, Ataturk's next goal became ensuring the independence of Turkey and reversing many of its terms of surrender. That's interesting.
So that already lost the provinces. Yeah. So at the end of the war, I think it was the French, the British, Greeks had largely carved up the rest of their provinces. There was only the heartland left.
Yeah, right.
And they were going through the process of chopping it up and saying, well, you have this bit, you have this bit. And, you know, that was the last straw, essentially.
The Sultan actually commended him to death.
Yeah. He committed him to death in absentia.
Yeah, wow. And but he was then had victory in the 1919 elections. After leading anti-armistice candidates, saw him able to effectively guide the Turkish independence. So he had all these leading anti-armistice, you know, people rally around him, and then he buoyed up their political objectives and became the front man. Must have taken huge guts.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, and he opposed the Sultan's authority, and yeah, he was just really someone who Turkey all rallied behind, and I think it was the Gallipoli victory that really started that sort of movement.
Yeah, well, I mean, he'd always had that modernization objective. He didn't see the Sultan, you know, was already decaying. The whole country was already decaying prior to World War One, let alone after it. And, you know, with the loss of its provinces and the economy having collapsed and those sorts of things. And when he went out into the regional areas, and, you know, they tried to recall him, and they, you know, ended up convicting him and you know, sentencing him to death. That's essentially where he started to raise his army of peasants to overthrow the Sultanate.
And luckily he did, because otherwise a few years later they would have been talking Greek.
Well, indeed, yeah, that's exactly right.
Because the Greeks hadn't forgotten history from a long time ago, and they were still moving towards the Ottoman Empire and taking land. Yeah, and I think it was around, was it 1922, Battle of Sekaira? One thing we've learnt through this so far is that I cannot pronounce anything that isn't Australian. Sekaira.
Yeah, interesting. Before that battle, though, the Greeks had attempted to invade and overrun Ataturk and his, you know, small defensive forces. Again, they were quite agricultural. They were peasant based, very
guerrilla warfare,
rudimentary weapons. It was guerrilla warfare, and based in a region of Turkey that was quite difficult to get at. You know, there was no railway lines out there. You had to be on horseback or on carriage to get out there, so it was quite isolated. And that was a problem for anywhere outside of metropolitan areas of Turkey, was that it was all quite agricultural and still isolated, very backward in that respect. And despite that, the Greek expeditionary force was routed. And that gave not only Ataturk...
And that's 100,000 troops on the ground with artillery and air support.
No, that was about a year later. So this was earlier. So the first battle, the Greeks worked out that they were up against someone, even though it was a peasant army that largely was quite effective. And they all surprised themselves, and the Greeks were surprised, and even Ataturk to some extent. And it was a year later during this battle that they came back with 100,000 troops with air support, not a huge air force, but some air support, artillery, those sorts of things. And essentially Ataturk drove them into the Mediterranean and then sacked their towns.
And what was the second order effect after that? Was there a treaty at all, or was it pretty much just done and dusted?
Yeah, the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923.
Was that follow on, did it? Okay.
Indeed. Yeah, so he insisted on no Allied control of any Turkish finances or territories, especially the Dardanelles.
Mm.
And his insistence on the Turkish independence, coupled with his continued victories in the war, saw the Allies accept sovereignty and recognize Ataturk as the president of Turkey. See, largely Greece was representing the rest of the Allied forces, so the French and the British.
Mm.
But it was predominantly the Greeks that were, you know, doing the attacking, and they lost, and so that was it. It essentially defined the borders at that point.
So you've got to remember now, we're talking 8 years after Gallipoli.
Yeah, Gallipoli, and about five years four or 5 years after the end of the war.
And he's now president of Turkey. He's modernizing it socially, politically, economically. It's democratic for use of a loose term, and he was protecting it from communism and fascism, which was to the top of him and the left of him. And he banned far left and far right parties completely so they could protect democracy. And his party, the People's Party, was the only political party in Turkey, allowing him to effectively rule without, you know, whilst also using elections as a means to measure his popularity, really. He was just asking people what they thought of him. And he made sure there was a separation of powers between judiciaries, legislators, and the president. So it all seems to me like real modernization. And he sought to diminish the influence of Islam in Turkey, although not outlaw it, but he did ban the caliphate, or the idea of a caliphate, and made all education secular. He banned Sufi religious orders and eliminated Islamic courts. I mean, this is modern stuff. If you think about that, what was it that drove him to be so opposed to Islam running political structures?
His education. So he'd studied widely the Western powers and the Western systems, and he was, I think, embarrassed, like hopeful for the future, but embarrassed by the state of his country. And as he travelled around, you know, in his early military career, he was actually able to compare what Turkey was experiencing to the Western world, and certainly that education reinforced that. And he 100% knew early on that there was little future for Turkey without modernizing and westernizing. So
the world look like if Turkey had become an Islamic state of, you know, as in purely driven by Islam in the modern world? I mean, that would be
It largely was at the time.
Yeah.
That's what he was fighting against.
Mm.
You know, and up until recently, it had a very strong connection with the US.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know, strong allies. And you know, I'm not tracking exactly, you know, the level of that strength now, but certainly it had a very strong relationship with the US.
I've been there in recent years, and I mean, there's obviously been a lot of reporting as well around Turkey's position in recent years, but it's safe to say when you talk to Turkish people on the street, they really are progressive. Like they're for all intents and purposes, they are nestled in between the Middle East and Europe, and it is a melting pot of ideas. And yes, yeah, in my mind, it's successful at this point.
Yeah.
And so he opened up political participation, you know, to multi-party elections in 1930. Yeah, and economically nationalist in their thought. He won every election until his death in 1938.
Whilst he was a dictator for a period of time, largely a dictator for a period of time, he did intend to always give it a Western democratic structure.
Yeah, he was... You know,
That's what he's building towards.
Democratically dictatorial.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That wasn't the only thing he did reforming the political system. He did so much more, like developing the modern railway network. You know, I was talking about before.
Before you go into that, just one point. He ensured that the army was independent of not only Islam but also the political system. So it wasn't commanded by someone within the political hierarchy. It's very similar setup to what we've got in Australia now. Maybe a little bit looser, actually, because the reason for that is so the army could actually launch a coup. You know, deliberately launch a coup to protect Turkey's secular democratic constitution if it was infringed. So,
well, it did so recently.
Well, it tried. How'd that work out? But imagine if you had been told that in Kamal's vision. So if you were the general in charge, you've now got the power to think about what Kemal would want you to do, what Ataturk would want you to do. And I wonder if that played into recent years' events. I never realised that until we did the research for this, that the army was actually set up like that deliberately to try and stop it from becoming secular. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is amazing.
To protect it so that it would remain secular. Mm.
Secular, that's right, yeah. Like I was saying, he did so much more than that as well. And in this short period of reformation, he developed the modern rail network, the modern banking sector, which was based on the Germany system.
Yeah.
The new penal code based on Italy's civil code based on Switzerland.
Just taking all the best.
Which just shows that he was widely read. He had a grand vision, and he wasn't doing it slowly either. Yeah, he personally pursued the application of all these reforms. He was a role model. He actually went about and was participating in the design and the execution of the rail network, for instance. He was absolutely front and center. I don't know where he had time to sleep and do all of this. Because he did it over a period of 6 years, and not just that, a whole bunch of social reforms as well.
I'll tell you what else he did. He made men and women equal legally in 1926. Yeah. I mean, we're talking 50 years earlier than some Western nations, and passed bans on veils for the Muslim women. Like what was that in his mind where he took the best of Western civilization and said, let's adopt this. And can you imagine the pressure that would have been against him?
That's right, the religious side of the house. But he was married for a couple of years to a woman named Latifa, and she was one of the first to move around. And he valued Latifa highly and loved her dearly. She was one of the first women to move around the country unveiled. There's actually video footage of her doing it while he's on, you know, one of these grand tours with all of his advisors and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But he also banned the fez, you know, the Turkish headdress, fez. He banned that mainly because the fez represented the symbol of previous, you know, Ottoman Empire. So it was a symbol of the Ottoman Empire. So he banned that. And he also introduced Western names, particularly surnames.
Right.
You know, we think this is, you know, we take that sort of stuff for granted, but yeah, he introduced it.
And the new alphabet.
Modified Latin characters, yeah. So it made literacy and education simple for
well, it doubled the literacy rate in 20 years. It doubled the literacy rate in Turkey. And he moved to protect women's rights and gave them political rights in 1934, and there was more Turkish MPs being women than in the UK and the US combined.
Yeah, 18 of them.
I mean, and, you know, obviously, because they probably represented half the population. They should have been half. Anyway. He also promoted education, accelerated rapidly under his leadership. He promoted strong nationalism through a policy of Turkification, which sounds like making great, you know, chicken and eggplant and sun-dried tomato sandwiches, but it's not. It was about the history, language and culture of Turkish society, you know, and showing the best of it. And I think that he probably saw it as a modern version of Italy and Greece as well, you know. and sought where they could become a Mediterranean, sort of nestled in between Europe and the Middle East. And his view was absolutely realised. There was co-education of women resulted in 10% of uni graduates being women at the time of his death in 1938, which in the world standing was huge. The elimination of polygamy.
Polygamy. So multiple wives.
Mm. I mean, I can't forgive him for that.
Right. I'll leave that one alone.
I'm joking. And equal inheritance rights.
Yeah, and Western clothing.
Right.
So he, it goes back to that statement about the fez when he got rid of the fez. Mm. It was he literally introduced the wearing of the hat. So he said, we're going to wear shoes. And he said this in a speech, quite an empowering speech. And he talked about we're going to wear shoes, we're going to wear trousers, we're going to have shirts, waistcoats, jackets, and this is called a hat. And we're going to wear this. You need to have a head cover that has a brim. That's called a hat.
Mm.
And that was part of one of his speeches. He literally stood in front of a massive crowd and said this. Mm. Crazy.
So interesting. Crazy stuff. His pros are for the way that he went and enacted all of this. This is really interesting, I think you'll find. Providing purpose and direction, 10 out of 10, the pros. He had a real clear vision. He used consistent application, had goals, and he had very little opposition to his objectives. Interestingly, the cons are that while he was creating all of these systems that were stopping things like he banned political parties, he had legal requirements following socially progressive platforms. He was doing it while actually acting as a dictator. So he was building democracy by a dictatorial leadership style. And so it was really contradictory. What he was doing on one hand with these presidential powers was exactly what he was trying to stop.
But he knew it. He knew he needed to give himself space.
Yeah.
He needed space. He needed to protect himself. And he always believed that his view was right. Mm. Like right back from when he was an officer cadet, he sought at every conversation. So this is an interesting aspect. He sought in every conversation to ensure that his opinion prevailed.
Yeah.
And he did that through sheer energy and force of will, even though he wasn't the smartest guy in the room every time.
Who was the other who was the other guy that was doing that same time? We've talked about him already.
Yeah, Hitler.
And
Churchill.
Mostly Churchill. Hitler was just crazy. But Churchill believed and would bash people into submission verbally until they believed with him.
Well,
There's some real correlations.
So did Ataturk.
Yeah, so did Ataturk.
Yeah,
okay, so leadership style, again, I gave him 10 out of 10. Ataturk's leadership style, from a military and political capacity, in a military capacity, his style was dictatorial, delegative. He was a traditional military officer. However, he also understood providing purpose, motivation, direction, and the power of the energy transference, as we said before. He was seen, probably the Gallipoli campaign was really where it came into sharp focus, how that worked. And you've got to think that he saw, if I'm the strong man but the benevolent sort of dictator, then that works. That then followed on in the Turkish War of Independence. And he just continued to take it on.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think we've already identified you're an easy marker. I'm not sure I would sort of rate him as 10 out of 10, and mainly because of that dictatorial style. I think he's certainly a transformational leader. There's no denying that his transformational leader. He was able to develop a shared vision, a culture, and a means for enables transformation of an entity, in this case, a nation, from its current state, a visionary state, by inspiring the followers to maximize contributions for the betterment of the country.
Yeah.
He was a genius. He was a liberator, a founder. He was enlightened, but he was also very, very forceful, sometimes aggressive. His personality was very much involved in his leadership style, and he was quite controlling at times as well.
Yeah, and it was the same really for him politically too, wasn't it? He would lead by example when it suited him. Very good at controlling that narrative, and then and then he would, behind closed doors, he'd ban things that were going to provide him any friction. But perhaps he saw that as a tool.
His wife, yeah, and his divorce from Latifa, who I mentioned previously, was largely around that. Mm. So he wanted his country to go through the reform process in, you know, in a very short period of time, and it was achieved in 6 years. And yet his wife wanted him to, you know, stop drinking, you know, like he was a bachelor in the, you know, in the officer's mess. he was essentially told to, you know, stop associating with other women and going out and partying and all of that sort of stuff. Mm. And she wasn't especially tolerant to some of his wayward behaviours, of which there were a few. And in fact, he died of cirrhosis of the liver, in fact, in 1938.
Wow.
And, you know, and she was trying to get him to change rapidly and he wouldn't. So he divorced her.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, and that is modern and progressive in itself in that era. Mm. But also, listen, I gave him 10 out of 10 and you've been busting my balls over it. But I'm not saying that it's 10 out of 10 because he's the perfect leader now. I'm saying it's 10 out of 10 because he was the leader that they needed, you know, to bring the success that they had is absolutely testament to his dictatorial style. And him consistently pursuing those objectives like a dog with a bone, you know, he was so effective. And I don't see how anyone else would have been effective. I think they would have been just eaten
more,
up. And
more
would,
of the same.
Yeah,
more
yeah of the absolutely. Same. Yeah. You know? And you know, I will caveat that by saying that he showed a bit of flexibility. There was some delegation, you know, there was participation, but primarily it was dictatorial. But he didn't allow for other suggestions on how to implement his vision. And this might have led, you know, we talk about the most resilient team being the most diverse team, and he certainly had diversity around him, but he wasn't listening to it all. So perhaps that limited the growth, you know, of himself and actually Turkey as a whole.
Maybe he, in fact, exiled some of his closest advisors after the Reformation was completed.
Mm.
So, you know, he'd had these guys throughout his career, his military career, and through the War of Independence and the transformation. And then there were, some of them were gone after that.
Mm.
So he did get what he needed, and it came at a cost. It certainly came at a cost.
Rightio, enduring legacy. I'm going to go with 8 out of 10. Legacy both at home and abroad. He's internationally and domestically widely regarded as an excellent general. And if he wasn't there, if he wasn't in Gallipoli, chances are Monash was, you know, someone like Monash would have
got up over the top.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we already know what a brilliant, you know, one of the most brilliant Australians. He's hailed for his principled leadership of Turkish nationalists during the War of Independence. Provide strong political direction. What else? Enduring legacy. You know, he was secular, progressive.
Yep.
Massively progressive, if you think about what we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, an Islamic country in the 1920s and 30s. You know, we've seen the speed that religion can, you know, whether rightly or wrongly, I don't know, but it spreads fast. And he was able to say, hey, great, but, you know, I assume he said something similar to this, no problems with Islam, but not in politics. In politics, we are about politics, not about,
for sure.
Is huge, really. Yeah, he outlawed insults against his own leadership. There was an outlawing of insults against his leadership in 1951, which was 11, 12 years later after his death.
Yeah, they enshrined him, essentially.
Yeah, and he's seen, you know, similar to Winston Churchill and Billy Hughes. Yeah, and famously, now they are our sons, speech honouring Gallipoli. There's a statue of him in every Turkish city or town. And, you know, like we've all got Margaret Thatcher above our kitchen tables in Australia. Most households have portraits.
Not so much.
Most households have portraits of him. I remember in Tully we used to have this amazing photo of Queen Elizabeth up on the, and I mean, she must have been in her late 20s. And as a 20-year-old guy in Tully, you'd look up there going, yeah, you know, she's all right. Is that, can I go to prison for saying something like that? I'm not sure.
Possibly. Again, I'm staying out of this one.
Yeah. No, but I mean, that was, you know, if you think back to, so what's Tully, the, you know, that's 80s, 70s and 80s. And that was still, and I mean, in the army today, we've still got photos of the monarchy everywhere, you know, part of the Commonwealth. And so Turkey, really similar with photos of Ataturk in every household.
Well,
now.
Interestingly, so did, you know, it was similar in Iraq, as you know, there were paintings and pictures of Saddam in every lounge room, effectively.
Yeah, and his legacy has come under increased attack and scrutiny by ideological opponents within Turkey.
Yeah.
You know, obviously he's an easy target because he was stating a good game, but he was being undemocratic and dictatorial. And, you know, there's some criticism around the complicity in the massacres of Armenians and Greek civilians during World War One.
Yeah, and the Dersim massacre in 1938, where, you know, 13,000 Kurds were killed. You know, that's another black spot. You know, he wasn't very good at pairing different backgrounds of, you know, in groups together. Wasn't had strong vision. He had his team, but he didn't necessarily excel in bringing large groups together. And I think that's what detracts from his performance compared with some of the others who could unite multiple nations together.
So that was, and I think so. President Erdogan now probably uses some of the very fast maneuvering back then towards westernization as a weakness, and sees Kemalism as, well, he sees it as a way to further nationalize Islamic Turkey, which is interesting when you think that it's come full circle in that regard. Although there's probably some similarities between how the current president and Ataturk run the show. There's some similarities.
Well, you know, Erdogan's trying to roll back a lot of the advances that were made by Ataturk. So there's been some regression since then, for sure.
Yeah, it's a shame, really. Yeah, and I don't think these diminish the impact or influence of Kemal's leadership, really. It just demonstrates the fact that they see the way he led and the progressiveness of Turkey as something to fear.
Yeah, well, I guess we haven't really spoken about his character too much, but he was a firm leader, quiet, calm. You know, he was generally quite a sentimental person. He loved children and music and nature, and he preferred peace over war, despite his background, of course. You know, essentially, he managed to successfully steer his country between Nazism and communism, which was probably no easy feat at the time.
And walked a fine line of
really fine
westernization, democracy, and the old sort of very, very strong historical Islamic underpinning of Turkey. It's such a beautiful place, and it's such an interesting, rich place now, full of history and perspectives. And it'd be a shame to see that go the annals of history as just a spot where it was once. You know, you were once able to go there, and in the future you can't.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I saw a quote from his chief of staff, and you know, as he passed away, his chief of staff even then said, "Look, you know, here's a piece of history slipping away."
Wow.
You know, so right then on his deathbed, chief of staff was there, and even then it was identified that, you know, we're seeing the end of an era.
No one to carry the mantle.
Yeah, exactly. And he single-handedly.
Well, that lowers the score if you think about it. If you haven't been able to set up someone in your absence to continue your life's work, then how successful a leader have you really been?
Well, I think that's partly because he did it so quickly. Yeah. So he did the transformation in 6 years. Now, I think that part of his problem is the fact that had he taken a little longer, had he taken 12 years, you know, he probably would have been able to be less abrasive with some of the institutions.
He was drinking a liter of alcohol a day, mate. Like he was.
He knew he didn't have time. He knew he didn't have time. Yeah. You know what? There's no way you can be running at that level, being so energetic, doing so much. I think maybe he knew he didn't have time. He was always a heavy drinker.
I wonder if he was profoundly affected by Gallipoli and the years later, and that turned him to the drink, perhaps. The horrors of war, you know, and we're not talking about, you know, patrolling through the back ends of, you know, far north Queensland. We're talking about being bombed every day for hours and then seeing people run at you with bayonets, you know. So how it ended for them? Mm. Oh, look, I gave him 10 out of 10, but I wish I hadn't now. I look at it and think, you know, when you're drinking a litre of alcohol a day, you die at 57. It's not ended well.
Could have ended better.
Yeah, let me change that to 5 out of 10. First time we've ever done this.
But what about? Yeah, have I swayed you the other way?
You have, because I think he's done so much in such a quick amount of time, but he had so much more to give, and it's just a life that's gone. You know, and if he had have been even more modernized, become, and then if he had done something like raised 3 political parties from his own political party that have differing opinions, and then let the people have the vote. We could have seen an amazing democratic society that, and I mean, you know, we're not necessarily saying that democracy's right or wrong, because, I mean, what we're seeing at the moment around the world, who bloody knows? But at least it's the best we've got, you know. And he had more to give, I think. 15 years.
I wish he'd been around longer.
Yeah,
I wish he'd been around longer, and I think the transformation would have been embedded far better.
And I wonder what would have happened in the Second World War.
Yeah, true.
You know, you had someone like that, decisive, right?
Yeah. This,
you know. Look, I gave him overall 42 out of 50. Was going to be 47, but deducted points because he drank too much. You know, he used his inspiration to launch himself into the position as Turkey's war hero, which then, you know, he ended up becoming, you know, he then pushed independence, saw him guide through the nationalists. He sought to create an independent Turkey with himself as a leader, and he did it. The father of independent, you know, Turkey. And he was inspirational, motivational, although dictatorial. He reformed an old, archaic Ottoman, you know, really ancient old system, really, into a vision for a new, secular, progressive Turkey, which he did through creating an ideology of Kemalism, which really was taking the best, as we saw, as you quite rightly outlined, the best from all those Western and European successful democracies, and he taught the best of them. And his life ended when he was the founding president, its greatest leader of the 20th century. And he's woven through the social fabric of Turkey, ingrained in them, probably much the way that, you know, I guess, who would be similar in Australia in that way?
Not sure that we've had anyone as transformational.
Some people would say maybe John Howard, but, you know, that is really content. And he definitely didn't have the same level of support that someone like Ataturk had.
I think you know, he saw himself as a Washington. There's no question of that. In fact, he's, you know, he has stated it on a couple of occasions.
Here's my question to you then, Trent. So if we say, let's round this out, right? 42 out of 50, done. Mm. Okay, it's not brilliant, not terrible, but amazing for Turkey at that time. The modern world now, with the pace of technology and the 24-hour news cycle and the existence of conspiracy theories spreading faster than truth, are we ever going to see leaders like this again, like your Churchills, like your Eisenhowers, you know, like your Washingtons, like your Kemal, like your Ataturks? Are we going to see people like that again?
Yes.
Do you think?
I think circumstances will always occur in human history that will bring leaders to the fore in the environment that they are faced with.
Right. What year are we in?
2020.
2020, so it is the 6th of November 2020. In 4 years' time, I think we will see President Obama, Michelle Obama, and she will be one of the greatest leaders of the modern era. I'm calling that out now. And I want people to come back to this podcast and go, that Connolly's an international relations genius. But that's what, maybe that's what the world needs, you know? We need that.
Someone.
We need a hero.
We certainly need someone, and or a number of someones. But as we said during the Churchill podcast, we haven't needed someone since Churchill, since that time of World War II. We haven't needed leaders like that. There hasn't been a requirement.
And now maybe we do.
I think there are bigger challenges to come, and I just think that most people barely achieve their goals and visions in their lifetime now. Most people on the planet have some goals, some visions, and most don't even get to those.
Mm.
This particular individual had a vision around the complete reformation of his country.
Wow.
And did it in six years.
No big deal.
You know, it's... So when we compare Ataturk to pretty much anybody else on the planet ever, he's right up there.
He's
so
successful.
He's successful.
Genghis Khanish. That's what we're talking about.
Him. Yeah. Yeah, indeed, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. And when we say leadership is getting people to do what you want them to do because they want to do it. 6 years, you had to get a lot of people doing what you wanted them to do and they wanted to do it.
Mm.
Incredible. We can't even get people to wear face masks. Alrighty, that's it for this week on the Warrior U podcast. We've pulled this one apart. What do we got next week? Who we got? Oh, good gracious. We've got next week the Shah of Iran. That'll be interesting.
Holy dooly.
And then we're going to get into some Americans. Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan. Then we're going to go Oliver Cromwell. And I thought we'd go back in history and go Napoleon. We're counting them down. We're getting towards Marcus Aurelius, mate.
Excellent.
20 weeks to go, and then we're at Otto Scorzini. This is how I'm keeping you hanging on. All righty. Thanks again, Trent. See you next week.
Thanks, Brian.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.